The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post and National Geographic Traveler. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we are going to journey to the nation's capital, where some well-known tourist attractions have been or will be undergoing needed improvements. Among them, the Washington Monument, which has been closed for many months before reopening in September. In the week that the monument was reopened to the public, the Washington Post published some articles that provided details about the renovations and a look back at the history of the monument. First, a brief look at the Washington Monument. This was published August 17th in what is called the Washington Kids Post and written by Aaron Stuckelberg. And he writes, "The monument was built to honor George Washington. He was the commander of the Continental Army, which he led to victory over Britain and independence for the nation during the Revolutionary War, soon after he was elected as the United States' first president. The nation's capital city, Washington, D.C., where the monument is located, is also named after him." So, just a kind of a refresher for us in American history there. Well, next, Associated Press writer Ashraf Khalil provides details about the reopening in his September 18, 2019 article, "Washington Monument Reopens After Three-Year Closure for Repairs." After a three-year closure, the Washington Monument is reopening to the public. The 555-foot stone obelisk was closed in September 2016 in order to replace the aging elevator and upgrade security systems. The monument reopened to the public at noon Thursday, September 19th, and First Lady Melania Trump attended the ribbon-cutting ceremony. "We're just excited to open it again," said National Park Service spokesman Mike Litterst during a Wednesday tour of the site. "The views from up here are like nothing else," he added. The monument has been closed for most of the past 8 years. An August 2011 earthquake left cracks in the stones near the top of the obelisk. It reopened in 2014, but park officials were forced to close it again 2 years later after a series of elevator malfunctions. "It was two or three times a week," Litterst said. "We couldn't guarantee that you wouldn't get stuck." Construction on the monument began in 1848 and took nearly 40 years to complete. The private organization that was running the project ran out of funding, and construction was halted in 1854 at around 150 feet. That delay was exacerbated by the Civil War. Construction resumed in 1879, but builders were forced to use stone from a different quarry, giving the obelisk its distinctive two-tone color. At the time of its completion, it was the tallest building in the world, but was soon overtaken by the Eiffel Tower in 1889. It remains the tallest building in Washington, and when open, averages about 500,000 visitors per year. So some more information for you about the Washington Monument. And in the mention of the August 2014 earthquake, if you lived here in the Raleigh area, you felt some of the tremors from that earthquake. I was working in an office downtown right behind the governor's mansion at the time. And I was sitting in a roller chair at my desk, and the rattle rolled me across my office floor. And so, in fact, it set off alarms in our building. We had to evacuate. We weren't sure what was going on at the time. So I remember that event quite well. Well, Michael Rosenwald, an enterprise reporter writing about history, the social sciences, and culture, provided some interesting historical context about the Washington Monument in his September 19, 2019 article, "The Washington Monument Was Still Being Built When the Know-Nothings Attacked It." So for you history buffs, you're going to enjoy this, I think. In 1854, the anti-Catholic party stole the stone the people had donated to the obelisk. And that's the small headline preceding the article, and we began. "The attack on the Washington Monument began just after midnight. Nine men snuck up what was still a construction zone, the tower reaching just more than 170 feet. They poisoned a guard dog, they tied up the night watchman, and they hunted for the Pope's stone. The brazen attack on the monument in March 1854 was a coordinated effort by the Know Nothing Party, an anti-Catholic, anti-immigration group that feared Pope Pius IX had plans to take over the United States. Members replied, "I know nothing," anytime anyone asked them a question. Frustrating. The Know Nothings were nervous that the Pope, like other foreign and religious leaders, had sent a slab of marble to be placed inside the monument, which reopened to the public Thursday, amid much fanfare after damage from that 2011 earthquake. As they snatched the stone, they reportedly loaded it into a rowboat and dumped it in the Potomac River. At least that was the story a saloon keeper told the Washington Post, requesting anonymity. The attack could not have come at a worse time. The Washington National Monument Society, a private organization raising funds for the project, was out of cash. Soliciting stone donations from states and foreign governments was the 1850s version of a Kickstarter campaign, but it wasn't enough. The stubby, uncompleted monument became a national eyesore. A year after the attack, the Society asked Congress for money to complete the project. Congress was on board, approving $200,000, the equivalent of $6.1 million in today's George Washington's. Who knows who wasn't happy with Congress stepping in, or you know, rather, who wasn't happy? The Know-Nothings, according to the National Park Service's history, and it goes, the night before, however, a group of about 750 members of the Know-Nothings, many of whom had joined the Washington National Monument Society, called a meeting. They voted 17 of their own officers into the society, and the next morning announced that they were in possession of the Washington Monument. Congress tabled the resolution. 2 weeks later, the project's architect, Robert Mills, died. And you know what the Know-Nothings did next? Essentially nothing. They added 3 feet to the monument. 3 feet. In 1858, as the Know-Nothings self-combusted, the original society wrestled back total control. When the women stepped in with several foundings, the Ladies Washington National Monument Society, an offshoot of the original group. The Ladies' Society was, in short, having as much trouble prying open American wallets as their male colleagues, wrote John Lockwood, in the men and the women who built the Washington Monument. In 1860, the women reported raising a whopping $154.46 when the Civil War broke out. The country had bigger problems than this stubby structure, which now stood paused at 176 feet. The whole neighborhood took a turn for the worse, as a matter of fact. Following the Civil War, the swamp-like grounds of the Washington Monument became known as Murderer's Row, as they became the hangout of escapees, deserters, and all other types of flotsam of the war, according to the National Park Service. It wasn't until 1876, amid a patriotic wave leading up to the country's first centennial, that Congress passed a law allowing construction to resume. On December 6, 1884, construction was completed, with the tip of the obelisk reaching 555 feet. The dedication took place the next year, the day before Washington's birthday, which fell on a Sunday. The Park Service's history described that moment. Washington's birthday that year was clear and cold, and the sharp wind blowing down the Potomac chilled the assembled crowd. The ground at the base of the majestic shaft was encrusted with snow, but it was a great day for the men who spent years completing the monument as the obelisk to the father of his country stood noble, proud, majestic, and serene. It represented the ideals of America. And it was the tallest building in the world until the Eiffel Tower in Paris knocked it off that pedestal. So, more interesting information about the monument there. Well, as visitors return to see the revived Washington Monument, work is underway on another nearby structure. Michael Ruane writes in the August 20, 2019 issue of the Washington Post, bugs and bad weather have had their way with the Jefferson Memorial. Now the Park Service is fighting back. And the subheadline, an $8.2 million project is underway to restore and reclaim the monument from the ravages of nature. Spiders have moved in to dine on the bugs drawn by the lights. Wasps have built nests to eat the spiders, and a community of dark biofilm has spread out over the surface of the marble like spots on a giant leopard. Lichens have sprouted on the stone. Rain has pummeled the roof. And 76 years after it was dedicated, in the midst of World War II, the Jefferson Memorial has become a miniature and unsightly ecosystem. Now the National Park Service has embarked on an $8.2 million project to reclaim the Washington landmark from the creeping grasp of nature. Last week, that would have been August 19th, 2019, workers were putting up scaffolding to begin the complex process of repairing and replacing roof surfaces, cleaning giant marble roof tiles, and using lasers to attack the biofilm that has spread dramatically in recent years. Masonry damaged by water will be fixed, cracks will be repaired, and the insect colonies will be eradicated. The 32,000-ton memorial, which honors the nation's third president and main author of the Declaration of Independence, houses a 19-foot bronze statue of Jefferson. The site remains open, and the work should be finished by next spring. The task is varied, but probably the most visible thing that we're doing is to clean the memorial of the biofilm, says Audrey Tepper, a Park Service historical architect with the National Mall and Memorial Parks. We've been watching it grow ever since it was first noticed in 2006, she said. The film, a microbial community of fungi and algae and bacterial growth, Tepper said, has left a dingy gray shadow over one of the country's most beautiful structures. During the annual Cherry Blossom Festival, the Jefferson statue has been an exquisite backdrop for countless photographs. The memorial's white Vermont marble once was smooth and pristine, but has been badly eroded by weather. Now the sugary surface has become ideal for the growth, which likes all the nooks and crannies, Tepper said. The memorial sits on a fill dredged in the late 1800s from the Potomac River and on 634 pilings, and caissons sunk down to bedrock on the south side of the tidal basin. One support goes down through 138 feet of soft earth. Over its seven decades of life, the structure has been affected by the vagaries of Washington weather and by the capricious piece of ground on which it sits. As early as 1941, 2 years before its dedication, some of the supports under the memorial's main steps began shifting. They had to be lashed together with steel cable and turnbuckles, according to an engineering report done for the Park Service in 1965. Settlement also caused other support systems under the steps to bend slightly. The steps move so often that park rangers once kept a special tool at the site to realign them, the report says. Lesser settlement continued during the 1940s and 50s. By the 1960s, the front plaza, which was not supported by pilings, began to sink by as much as 3 feet, and $1.1 million in engineering projects was undertaken to bolster it with more pilings and supports. In 2010, a $12.4 million repair project shored up the memorial's poorly supported seawall, which also had been sinking into the tidal ooze. Above ground, the idea was that the white marble was really almost temple-like, neoclassical in design, Tepper said. White marble was kind of the ideal in terms of producing a memorial. So that's another thing, she said. How long would it take before everything was covered? Nearby, a team clad in green day-glow shirts worked inside a small hooded enclosure to test a lesser ablate or erase the film. The ablation occurs when a directed beam of pure light pulses at a targeted area of soiling, Tepper said. When the black biofilm heats up, it expands and is ejected from the surface and vaporizes. They're not sure how long the lasered stone will stay or if the biofilm will come back, but the work continues. As a giant wasp was cruised near the top of the memorial and the Potomac River stretched in the distance below, Tanya Rivers, a senior project for the Grunley Construction, which is doing the work, paused. It's a lifetime dream to say you've touched one of the world's most important structures, she said. Who gets to do this? Who gets to stand here? And don't forget that Reagan National Airport is not too far away, and trains and planes in the city are all growing around it, along with the wasp, bugs, and spiders. And that's why everybody wants a white memorial, because it's not white anymore. That's kind of interesting, huh? About the Jefferson Memorial and the cleanup going on there. And that article, again, written by Michael Ruane. Well, Michael Ruane, by the way, is a general assignment reporter who also covers Washington institutions and historical topics. In the May 29, 2019 issue of the Washington Post, writer Ronald G. Schaefer focused on yet another familiar D.C. landmark. This was the Lincoln Memorial as a pyramid, question mark. That wasn't the craziest idea pitched a century ago. As Schaefer learned, Congress had the final say on the design for the slain president's monument, and the competition was intense. So yet another story about another sightseeing location there in the Capitol. Here we go. Congress had the final say on the design for the slain president's monument, and as we say, the competition was intense, according to Schaefer. The memorial to President Abraham Lincoln was a sight to behold, a gleaming white pyramid-shaped structure that resembled a giant cake with eight layers rising above them all. At the top stood a statue of the great emancipator himself. That is what the Lincoln Memorial would look like if architect John Russell Pope's proposal had been adopted in 1912. Just a year earlier, lawmakers authorized $2 million to build a memorial to Lincoln. They appointed a 7-member commission headed by President William Howard Taft to recommend the design, but the final decision was up to Congress. After further debate and construction delay, the memorial was dedicated 97 years ago this week, and that would have been as of May 27, 2019. Pope's pyramid scheme was one of several ideas he submitted in a competition with fellow New Yorker Henry Bacon. Pope's terraced pyramid was styled after the ziggurat temple towers of ancient Mesopotamia's The Cradle of Democracy. The architect also suggested a four-sided Egyptian-style pyramid with portico entrances on each side. The concept of an Egyptian pyramid wasn't all that far-fetched. The neighboring Washington Monument, after all, is styled after an Egyptian obelisk. Pope wasn't the first to propose a pyramid for the national landmark. In 1800, Congress approved a plan by Benjamin Latrobe, the designer of the U.S. Capitol, to construct a pyramid with a floor 100 feet deep as a mausoleum for the remains of President George Washington. But the project was never funded. In 1837, architect Peter Force proposed to build the Washington Monument as a pyramid. Pope's ideas for a memorial to Lincoln weren't as bizarre as one proposed in 1867 by Clark Mills, who designed the equestrian statue of Andrew Jackson in Lafayette Square across from the White House. Mills proposed to build next to the U.S. Capitol a 70-foot-high bronze structure with no fewer than 36 separate figures, including six on horseback. Topping the memorial would be a statue of a seated Abraham Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation. The choices for the Lincoln Memorial in the early 1900s weren't limited to statues and structures. Many influential lawmakers and the fledgling automobile lobby pressed for the building a splendid boulevard between the nation's capital and Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where President Lincoln delivered his Gettysburg Address on November 19, 1863. House Speaker James Champ Clark, a Missouri Democrat, offered the ultimate argument for the highway. If Abraham Lincoln could be consulted about spending $2 million to build him a memorial, Clark said, he would undoubtedly want one that would do somebody that is now living or to live hereafter some good. The idea of a divided highway was dismissed as folly. An Abraham Lincoln Memorial Highway would be lined with saloons, roadhouses, merry-go-rounds, and whatnot, and would be disgrace rather than a fitting tribute to that great historic figure, scoffed Glenn Brown, Secretary of the American Institute of Architects. Even the memorial site stirred controversy. The commission planned to build it in the Potomac Park next to the Washington Monument. At the time, this was a remote, swampy area infested with mosquitoes. And legendary former House Speaker Uncle Joe Cannon, a Republican from Lincoln's home state of Illinois, vehemently opposed the site. "So long as I live," he declared, "I'll never let a memorial to Abraham Lincoln be erected in that expletive-deleted swamp." Cannon preferred a statue at Union Station near Capitol Hill. The commission and Congress ultimately agreed to upgrade the Potomac Park site and approved architect Bacon's proposal to build a huge neoclassical Greek Doric temple. The temple was based on the Parthenon in Athens. Bacon believed that a memorial to the man who defended democracy should be modeled after a structure from the birthplace of democracy, according to the National Park Service. Bacon's plan called for placing the statue of Lincoln inside the 99-foot-high temple. The commission chose sculptor Daniel Chester French to design the statue after seeing how huge the temple would be. French upgraded his planned statue of a 10-foot-high seated Lincoln to 19 feet plus an 11-foot base. Bacon's new design drew wide praise but also criticism. The Illinois chapter of the American Institute of Architects passed a resolution calling Bacon's design purely Greek and entirely un-American. Sculptor Gutzon Borgum complained, We are about to spend $2 million upon a cold, classical, meaningless temple with no mark outside about the humble man it memorializes. Into the middle of that, he said, we're going to drop a statue of Lincoln, and upon the doormat we're going to put Lincoln Memorial. Well, World War II slowed work on the final memorial, which ended up costing nearly $3 million, equal to more than $45 million today. Finally, the dedication was set for Memorial Day, May 30, 1922. About 50,000 people attended, including 78-year-old Robert Todd Lincoln, the late president's only surviving son. The crowd honoring the great emancipator was racially segregated. Keynote speaker Robert Moton, principal of the Tuskegee Institute, was the only African-American orator, and he wasn't allowed to sit at the speaker's table. Organizers picked Moton because of his moderation views on race, and they censored part of his advance speech. Moton departed from his prepared speech to note that among 30,000 persons convicted of disloyalty during the last Civil War, not a single one was colored. Former President William H. Taft, now the U.S. Chief Justice, presented the memorial to President Warren G. Harding, who also addressed the crowd. Everyone could hear the speeches, newspapers reported, because of the use of new devices called loudspeakers. Soon after, a reflecting pool was added between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. The memorial became a site for civil rights activities. On Easter Sunday, 1939, African-American Marian Anderson sang America from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial after being banned at the Daughter of the American Revolution's Constitution Hall because of her race. In 1963, the Reverend Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech from the Lincoln Memorial. Today, the Bacon French Lincoln Memorial is the most visited of all the monuments in Washington, drawing more than 7 million people a year. While Pope didn't get his pyramid designs accepted, his presence is felt throughout the nation's capital. He designed the Jefferson Memorial, Constitution Hall, and the West Building of the National Gallery of Art. Wow. Well, from the icons of Washington, D.C., let's hop across the Atlantic, where writer Onur Ungun is going to show us imperfectly perfect Istanbul, as he states in the August-September 2019 issue of the National Geographic Traveler. There's no better place than a Bosporus ferry to write a love letter to an unforgettable city. Here we go. A few months ago, I came across an online study that compared the places a city's visitors photographed to places its residents photographed. In some cities, like London and New York, visitors and residents took pictures in noticeably different places. In Venice and Rome, tourists took many more pictures than locals. In some cities, I won't name them so as not to hurt anyone's feelings, travelers couldn't find much to photograph at all. And then there was Istanbul. The study seemed to indicate that Istanbul's longtime residents took at least as many pictures as first-time visitors in the same spots, especially on the water, on the routes of the ferries that constantly shuttle between the two continents that the city straddles. Yes, there's a lot to love about Istanbul as the capital of Byzantine and Ottoman empires, and even of the Roman Empire just before its collapse. It has a rich history to offer. As a commercial and political center, and the largest city on earth for a very long time, it attracted many ethnic groups, all of whom left their marks. At its height, it was even called the city of the world's desire, and for good reason. The desire is still here for both visitors and locals. One day, I board one of the city's beloved ferries on the European side, and I stand on the open deck at the stern. As we depart, the city's modern silhouette emerges beyond the waters of the Bosporus. The air smells of spring and sea, and the sun disappears behind the Süleymaniye Mosque, considered by many to be the finest in Istanbul. The sky to the west glows orange and purple. I think this is going to be the sort of evening when the sunset has a different kind of beauty to it. One of the most famous poems about the city has this memorable line, I listened to Istanbul, my eyes closed. But this ferry ride is turning out to be the exact opposite. I see every element that should make a sound. Minarets, the spice bazaar, long lines of cars on bridges, crowded seafronts, seagulls, but none of their sounds reach me. Even seemingly silent are the seagulls which follow the ferry and hope that someone will toss them a piece of freshly baked simit, that's a sesame seed bagel. I only hear the sound of waves when the boats cut through the blue waters of the Bosporus and the occasional horn from the cargo ship. I'm left alone with the magnificent view. Or not so alone. I look at the people on the ferry. Some are enjoying the view with headphones on. Some, probably regular commuters, are more used to the view and are reading their books. One or two couples chat, snuggled together against the gentle breeze. Someone is on the FaceTime, sharing the view live. And there are a number of people leaning against the rails and taking pictures. There are photographs compiled by the analysis I'd read. Who knows who takes them? I do. You do. A student living on one continent going to school on another does. A busy civil servant. An influencer who'll get 50,000 likes on Instagram. An Uncle Ali who'll send them to his family's WhatsApp group. All take photos. It's nearly impossible not to, no matter how many times we see the view. Especially if it is spring and the sun is setting. From the ferry, from a terrace, from the Galata Bridge, or from the window of their own homes, thousands of strangers looking at the same sight share a connection. All of them are reminded that they are looking at a special city. Beautiful, sure, but Istanbul is not without its problems. Infamous traffic jams, lack of urban planning, inequality, just to name a few. But this is a topic for other articles or possibly hefty books. Despite everything, Istanbul manages to pull wonders out of its hat, not only with the kind of beauty that overwhelms you in a single glance, but also with stories that could only have happened here, that are happening right now, or that will happen in the future. Istanbul rises above mortal cities formed of buildings, roads, and parks. Istanbul is a city of exceptions. Everyone knows that. Cities don't sit on two continents. Istanbul does. Mosques don't have mosaics of Jesus. In Istanbul, they do. There is no such thing as seeing dolphins during your morning commute to work. In Istanbul, there is. It doesn't snow much on palm trees. In Istanbul, it does. In Turkish, the letter N is never followed by B. In Istanbul, it is. That is why for centuries people have been writing poems and songs about this city. That is why they have cast it in the best roles in films and novels. But Istanbul plays an utterly different role in each of these works of art. A melancholy city of lonely people in an old nostalgic movie. A giant and violent back alley in a noir thriller. A realm of wonders in a dreamy novel and an uncaring beauty in many, many songs. These roles seem contradictory at first glance, but they ultimately portray how Istanbul is actually many cities sharing a single identity. The moment the last punctuation mark is placed in the last sentence in any of these works, the city it portrays begins its journey toward the past, and a brand new city starts to take shape. But old Istanbul's continue to live on in the details. Istanbul's unique beauty comes from its inability to stay the same and its irrepressibility as well. Throughout history, whoever ruled Istanbul was able to shape it only to a degree. In the end, Istanbul does what it pleases. As my ferry passes cargo ships and the historic peninsula's historic minarets, I sense all those old Istanbuls. I don't see them from my boat. I don't hear them, but I feel them. And I can't help but think, if Istanbul were the kind of city where four minarets of Hagia Sophia were identical, as is almost always the case with mosques, perhaps it would not be loved as much. Istanbul will continue to change, and will continue to look at its old photographs with envy. But the day will come when the Istanbuls we have not yet built will take their place in somebody's memories. Maybe in the future, commuter ferries will only be running for nostalgia's sake. Maybe one day there will be a drone congestion in the old bazaar instead of a human one. Well, that brings us to a close of another edition of The Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed your journey today and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.